This Writer Centre Norwich podcast is brought to you from the City of Literature programme at Norfolk and Norwich Festival 2016.
Good. Well, I'm obviously, you can hear me. John's just gone out, so I can't thank him for those generous introductions. But let me add my welcome to his and say briefly what Rose and I have planned to do for the the next hour. We're going to start by just having a conversation, and the conversation is going to be focused on the new book, the Gustav Sonata. Then she'll give a short reading from the book, and then there'll be time for a Q&A. So that's how we think we'll spend the next hour or so.
So but start thinking out the questions. We don't have no questions.
But we'll see how things go anyway. And I think, Rose, the way I'd like to at least prompt the conversation is to, in a sense, compare this book, the Gustav Sonata, with your last novel, Merivale, A Man of His Time. Mm-hmm. I mean, that book, you were taking us back to one of your, I suppose, most celebrated characters. You were also taking us back to 17th century England. You were writing a novel that, in a way, has a serious subject. That's to say, it's a novel about growing old and about death and the experience of decay. And yet, I think partly because of its 17th centuryness, its restoration quality, it's got a comic tone to it, not least in the account of the way in which Merivale does in fact die. This novel is set in Switzerland. It covers a period from about 1937 through to the early 2000s. It's part of its focus is on the effects of the Second World War. And it's characteristic of your work, I suppose, that you're a great imaginative traveller. I mean, you set your novels in many different countries, in Denmark, in the United States, in New Zealand, and so on and so forth. But I just wondered what it was that prompted you, what were the sort of first hints that led you to want to write a book that was set in Switzerland during this particular period of time?
Well, I think the one's ability to remember back to what I call the kind of the first mystery of the book, i.e. the first moment where the germ of what is going to be a reasonably long fiction comes into one's mind. It's quite often quite hard to remember exactly what that moment is. So, in a sense, I think there's two answers to that question, John. One does relate back to my last novel, Merivale, which was the sequel written, I think, maybe a tiny bit too late, really, for the readers. The readers had sort of forgotten about Restoration by the time this book came out. But it was a book I wanted to write for a long time, and the style of it, as you say, it's very sort of rambunctious and fast-paced and big and baggy and noisy and all those things that Merivale is. And I did sort of feel something as I got to the end of that wherever I was going to go next, and of course I didn't know that this was where I was going to go at the time, that I wanted the style and the tone and the feeling in the book, the next book, to be very different, that I wanted it to be small and quiet. And this was kind of epic. You know, the Restoration Merivale novels are a bit epic. And I wanted to get away from the epic to something much smaller, sort of gem-like. And, well, friendship is a subject that goes through in different ways, both those fictions, and that's always fascinated me. But also, I was very drawn to the idea of neutrality. Set in Switzerland, Switzerland's neutrality we all know about. What I didn't know sufficiently about until I began researching for this book was how difficult it was for Switzerland at the time of the war to hold on to this neutrality. I just sort of imagined, because Switzerland is so kind of physically, geographically protected by its mountains, and it's so kind of sort of so used to this neutral state of mind that it wasn't too sort of agitating and tempestuous and terrifying for the Swiss to remain neutral during the war. But of course it was all those things for them. And I became really interested in this because they didn't know, in the event the Germans did not invade Switzerland, but they didn't know that they weren't going to do it. So there is a period of huge anxiety. And that sort of, I think, channeled very nicely with my idea of trying to create a kind of honourable young person. I mean, this novel starts when Gustav is a boy, who is brought up with this idea of neutrality, or what his mother calls self-mastery. And of course, it's personal neutrality, personal self-control, self-mastery, whatever you want to call it, is extremely difficult too. And I thought if I could marry these two things, the sort of emotional and intellectual development of this boy, and if I could marry that with much wider concerns about Switzerland and the war and so on, I might have something interesting. So I think that's exactly which came first. I can't really remember, but I know that the two rode along like that.
Certainly in the early stages of the novel, Gustav is subject to a kind of education in what it means to be properly Swiss. And as you say, that involves the question of self-mastery, of being able to control your emotion.
Yeah.
And yet, this novel has this wonderful first sentence, which is not about the control of emotion, but about its expression. Mm. And that is that Gustav loves, before anybody else, his mother. But what we discover, of course, is that his mother does not love him.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The book, although it's certainly, and I think very vividly, about that sense in which a culture shapes a person and seeks to shape a person, it's also about somebody, I mean, to move to Gustav for a moment as a character, whose first experience is one of not having the response that he most desires.
No. And this informs how he's able to be. He says at one point in the novel that he's so used to not being loved that it's not that it doesn't bother him, but he's just, this state of loving where you are not loved is a state that he's very familiar with. And it gives him a kind of strength. And I thought it can do all kinds of devastating things to people if they're not loved by, you know, by this time she's a single parent, but because Gustav's father dies when he's very tiny, so he never knows him. So he's got this single parent, this mother, who, for reasons which we learn in the part two, we might talk about the shape of this book at some point, that it's impossible for him. We learn why to a certain extent. And we know that the consequences of not being loved by a parent can be absolutely devastating. But I was very interested to create a character where actually it doesn't lead him to become a difficult, demanding, unkind, or kind of disillusioned person. What it leads him towards is caring for other people. The profession that he ultimately chooses is that of hotelier. He runs a small, very unassuming, but rather nice little hotel in this small town where this novel is set. And this is what he loves from sort of kindergarten onwards, is caring for, first of all, for things.
Yeah.
They're rearing silkworms in the kindergarten. He loves cleaning out the silkworm box and giving them new leaves and looking after the other children. It leads him to this, to the idea that actually in a cold world, which it is in all senses, it's a very, very cold world, the terrible Swiss winters, and this coldness which he experiences from his mother leads him to want to actually find his own warm centre and to give that to as many people as he can, but most particularly to his beloved friend Anton.
Which, I mean, leads to the other person in the friendship, in the study of friendship, which is Anton. And a very interesting and I think powerful effect of the novel, just to go back to Gustav again, is he seems to me to be a very remarkable modern hero, actually. But I'd like to come back to that a bit after we've talked about Anton a bit more, because, I mean, one of the things about the novel's historical context is that it's indirectly it's directly about the consequences of the Holocaust, and particularly how Switzerland responded to the refugee crisis that arose as a result of the Holocaust, that's to say whether they were to accept Jews into the country or not. And Anton, Gustav's friend, is Jewish, and in the novel there is a profound dilemma for Gustav's father, whom Gustav actually doesn't know, because this happens before he's born. But Gustav's father, who's in the police force, does the human thing, which is to accept a refugee into the country after there's been a ban placed on accepting any more refugees, so he acts against the rules. He does the human thing and suffers immensely as a result of doing the human thing. So there's this very, very powerful moral dilemma that is not quite at the centre of the novel, but sort of has consequences for all the characters' lives. Now, that seems a rather roundabout way, but it's somehow the case that the friendship between the two is suffused with this history, obviously because Anton himself is Jewish, but they partly have to deal with that in their friendship.
That's right, and I think perhaps what the reader fears, I don't know, I mean, it's perhaps foolish to anticipate what the reader is going to hope for and what they're going to fear, but I think what the reader fears is that that Gustav, for all his sweetness, for all his patience, for all his loving nature, is going, and for all his kind of heroic, we called him a hero. I mean, I think in a quiet way, he is quite heroic. His heroic, affection for and kindness towards the world in general. Well, I think what the reader fears is that horribly mirroring what happens to his father, that for doing a series of acts that are basically morally good, that he's going to be punished. And I think this is something that keeps the spine of the book kind of quite tight all the way through, so that we feel at any moment something really calamitous may happen to Gustav, and a calamitous thing does arrive in the last act, but it's survivable, as it turns out, almost anyway.
Yes, but I mean, it's interesting because of the way in which I just wanted to ask to take this question about the nature of the friendship a bit further too, because. And I'm not giving anything away by saying that one of the first things, the act of kindship that Gustav performs is to welcome Anton as a new boy into his school, a new boy who's nervous about his first day at school, and Gustav is the person allocated to help him.
Yes, Gustav's quite severe with him. He says, "Why are you crying?"
Yes.
Because he can't stop crying, this boy. He's very, very sensitive. He wants to be a pianist, and he's very, very... He's very beautiful, he's very sensitive, and he can't stop crying. That awful thing that little five-year-old kids sometimes get. Well, we all get it at the moment, so you just can't stop crying. And Gustav says, "Well, why are you crying?" And he says, "Well, I love my friends, and I'm missing my old school." And Gustav says, "I think that's really stupid. I think you shouldn't be not crying. You know, you're here now, so you need to get on with it." So there are little moments where his Swissness, his sort of hard neutrality, operates good effect actually on this very, very oversensitive boy, who gives in to his emotions all the time, all the time, all the time.
But then comes to, in some odd sense, dominate the relationship, and that's what was interesting to me about it, was the way in which, from that beginning, I mean, in a sense, Anton seems to become the person who has the whip hand in the.
Well, Anton is sort of, I mean, he's glamorous and he's talented and he comes from a rich family. Gustav is leading this really quite sort of tiny, impoverished, lonely little existence with his mother. And then he meets Anton, who is very beautiful and very talented. He has great hopes of a fantastic career as a pianist. But he also meets the two parents, the Jewish parents, Armin and Adriana, who are kind of the ideal parents. They've got, and they're not hyper rich, but they've got a nice apartment and they're very generous. And they invite invite Gustav around, and there's a grand piano in the apartment. So it's another world that he goes into, which of course is terribly seductive to him. He who exists, he has one toy in all his childhood, which is a train. It's a tin train, and it hasn't even got little proper compartments in it. It just has people painted on the windows. But I was making a tiny little point there about children and toys and being given, you know, a sort of surfeit of things, which I think is what confronts us all now. I mean, I noticed, for instance, how many things my tiny grandchildren have acquired in 5 years of life. It's quite shocking how much they've got. But of course, as a grandmother, I want to keep giving them more things. But what happens to Gustav is he's only got this one toy, this train, and he makes up little stories about the people that are painted on the train. He talks to them, and they talk back. I.e., what's happening there is if you give a child something very basic, just one thing like that, what it does is it cultivates imagination, and imagination leads to empathy. And I think this is Gustav's really strong suit, that he can imagine what it's like to be other people and to understand them.
Yes. And it's, in a sense, Anton's deficiency, that he...
Well, he's too selfish, he's too mercurial, yeah. He's too ambitious. I mean, he has to go through his own tragedy, Anton, because his dilemma is that he's very ambitious and he's very talented. But when it comes to playing in public, he is afflicted by a terrible, terrible, sick-making stage fright nerve. So he can't become, or he risks never to become, and I don't want to give away what happens towards the end, but he risks never to become the person that he knows he should be, and whom, of course, the parents want him to be. And what's rather good about what Gustav's relationship to this desperate ambition and endeavour is that he doesn't really mind whether Anton becomes this famous pianist or not. He just wants him to be happy.
Mm.
He of course understands that unless Anton can do it, perhaps he never will be happy. But he tries to make him happy in other ways.
Mm.
So he's the ideal audience for him. When Anton is playing just for his parents and for Gustav, he's not nervous at all. The minute he goes onto a stage, he had to come here and play for you guys, he'd be sick, you know. So, I mean, this is a thing that afflicts a lot of people, not just musicians. But, I mean, it's something I'm quite interested in, because writers don't have to do that thing of performing. You know, we just can quietly work away at the thing that we love. Whereas if you're an actor or if you're a musician, you have to do it at that moment, you know, like a boxer. You have to go on and perform, and sometimes that's exactly when you're not able to do it.
Mm. So, something about the novel's location in Switzerland, something about the novel's time scale, something about the relationship that is so central to it, this story of a friendship between two men and all the setbacks that it encounters and the things that both enable it and prevent it. All those things are part of the novel. But I wanted to change the focus a bit by talking about sort of how it's put together, not so much about its content, but about the way in which it's shaped. And in particular to go back to the novel's title, the Gustav Sonata, and which reminds me of another book of yours, which is imbued with musical silence.
Yeah.
And ask you what, well, in a sense to ask you why it's called that, but perhaps to be a bit more helpful in asking a question and say, when did the idea of using a sort of sonata form and a sonata analogy come to you in the writing of the novel? Was it something that was there from the outset?
It wasn't quite there from the get-go, because the title wasn't there. I worked with various other titles. I never seemed to be able to come up with a title, apart from Restoration, which came to me bang. And the Trespass title, I think, was there right from the start. But titles are quite difficult to get right. And then, I should think about a third of the way through the first section before I realised that actually this question of Anton and the music, that this novel would be kind of just in its form much more satisfactory if it could follow some kind of musical form. And it seemed to me that the sonata form, with its three modes, which is exposition, development, and then recapitulation, was ideal. I always saw it as being quite a short novel.
Mm-hmm.
and that this and sonatas are quite short musical forms. I don't think that, you know, I don't think it matters if the readers sort of pick up on how this works or not. I mean, I think this is true of a lot of endeavour that goes into writing. It's these kind of ideas and trying to make this work which, you know, keep me working. But I don't think it necessarily matters whether the readers sort of pick up on this in all its complexity and find kind of the perfect sort of satisfaction out of it. Some will and some won't. And I think that readers, I found myself, as I published some short stories last year, talking about the short story form and how difficult it is compared with the novel form, to which I think readers really like, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong later on with your questions, but that readers really like to surrender to the novel. They don't like to think about how it's working or what, you know, what the kind of the mechanics of it. They like to surrender to the story, which is why novels are so much more popular than short stories, which turn readers into critics, in my view. It is there, and I mean, to go on about it a little bit, there is this early exposition of who these people are and what is important in their lives and so on. And then the development, this is a little bit perverse, it develops backwards. Because what I felt about that was this thing, that you come to the end of the part one, and Gustav is really, he's almost like a sort of abandoned child at that, by this point. Although there is a kind of a magical moment at the end of part one that he shares with his friend on Thomas Mann's mountain. But I felt that what the reader is, the question that the prime question that the reader is asking when you get to the end of the part one is, why is his mother Emily so unloving? Why has she not got the capacity, this sweet little boy, to love him? And I felt that the reader is longing to know that. And if I just sort of gone forward, she would become an enemy for the reader. And I don't think readers like having enemies in books. They like to try to understand what's going on with everybody. And all the characters in some of my novels are flawed. In here they're not particularly, but in Trespass, for instance, every single one of the characters has deep flaws. But I think there's also enough kind of redemptive things about them to make them interesting. So I went back in time and retraced all the things that, as you mentioned at the beginning, about the difficulties that happened in Switzerland during the war, particularly with the relation to the refugees. And as John said, Gustav's father, Emily's husband, who is this assistant police chief, is deeply, you know, blighted and eventually dies from the sort of punishments that he receives for having broken an edict at a time of great tension. So the development goes back. What the development bit is doing is telling you how you got to the end of part one.
Yeah.
And then the recapitulation takes you forward quite a long way. And it's recapitulating on a lot of, in particular, imagery. I mean, Davos and the mountain and the piano imagery and all kinds of, and the hotel and so on. But it's taking you back to a lot of things that have been just, in a way, set up. But as I say, I don't think it matters whether the readers kind of realise how it's functioning. What I heard myself saying rather pompously at one stage about this novel, what are the Swiss good at making? They're really brilliant at making watches, and I want it to be like a Swiss watch, so that it's got a very kind of plain and beautiful face, but actually inside the workings are very, very complex. But as I want to say again, I don't think it matters if you, as the reader, don't understand how it works.
Do you think that the... I mean, just to push it a bit further, let's say that part of the pleasure that a reader takes in surrendering to a book is a pleasure in discovering that there's a musical analogy at work in it.
Well, I think with Music and Silence, which was all about the power of music, and also the circumstances in which we were talking about 17th century Denmark, the circumstances in which musicians had to play. There's a lovely trope in that book, which was something real that I discovered about in the 1630s in Copenhagen, in one of the palaces. King Christian IV of Denmark had this had housed his musicians in the wine cellar underneath the staterooms, like underneath here. And then he built this system of ducts and pipes that would bring the music up magically into the room. Now, we, in the 21st century, we know that music can just come out of the walls or from, you know, anywhere. But imagine that in the 17th century. And that is a legend that I heard about that. So the whole kind of framework of the book, that's the central image, and the whole framework of the book is to do with music, hearing it, where is it coming from, who hears it, who understands it, who can play it, who is deaf to it. Is it a moral flaw not to love music? Mm. The king's wife, for instance, says that she can't stand music. She thinks she just can't bear it. She can't even bear to see it written on the page. She says that musical notation is like mouse droppings. So it's a novel that is really spun around the idea of music and then the quality of silence. I heard myself talking about this on Private Passions the other day, that the quality of silence before a piece of music begins is different from the quality of silence that comes after it. That music actually touches us in a place that we almost can't describe. It sort of goes into our souls like nothing else. Whereas here, it is in a sense central to the way this novel performs, but not, it doesn't have quite that big centrality that it has in Music and Silence.
Just one more question, and then I know there's a passage that you're going to read from early on in the book. I was very interested in reading the novel in the way in which the narrative, the story, is not just continuous. It's not all told as in, so we know what has happened and what's going to happen next, and that fits into a sense of a continuity of time.
I think it's brilliant
for
you to pick that out, because that is quite important.
That's just why I wanted to ask you about it, because this is a book where there's a chapter and then there's an interval, and then there's another chapter, an interval of time. Time, as it were, passes between the chapters as well as in the chapters. Yeah. And I think it creates a fascinating effect, but I'd like to know how that came to you and what you were trying to do in, if you like, segmenting the novel in that way, making it discontinuous to a certain extent.
I was trying to replicate the way we remember our lives. Okay. I mean, Wordsworth's famous spots of time is absolutely spot on, isn't it? That we don't remember our lives as continuity. We remember certain things and then another thing and another thing, another thing. And they may be beautiful things, they may be very unhappy things, or all kinds of things, all kind of following, but with little gaps in the middle, or very sometimes very long gaps. Which I think also it gives the novel a bit of breath. I didn't want it to be too sort of dense. I wanted it to be a novel that the readers can find their way through very easily. I also think another thing about daring to write like that is that readers are absolutely up to it. I think some writers underestimate how clever readers are and how much they like to work. I mean, I know this in doing my own reading of other people's. If they've left me little challenges here and there, and I'm being invited to piece things together, I really like that. I mean, it's frustrating if I can't do it, but I mean, I think there's nothing in here that is too opaque. I think the readers can fill in the gaps very well. I think I was aiming for something else, which is sort of the kind of staccato-ness of these little short. I mean, we call them, for want of a better word, I call them chapters, but actually they're little bursts of things that happen, and then there's a silence, and then another little burst. And I do think this is exactly how we remember our lives. And there's a lot about memory, particularly in the last section. It's a lot about memory and selective memory, and also about forgetting.
I think it's also interesting because it's, in some senses, it's a novel that's about the weight that the past can place upon the present, and the different demands that can make.
And we're all familiar with that.
And interestingly, but doing it in the way that you have done actually almost acts as a kind of counterforce to that, because it opens up the novel to the possibility that things might happen that nobody could predict or foresee. I mean, it creates a kind of sense of contingency which can work one way or another.
Yeah.
And so it has a curious effect.
My hope is that feels real.
Yes.
I mean, that's another thing that, I mean, after these famous 40 years, you know, that I've been working away, I mean, this is one thing which I do find myself hoping about my work, is that it feels truthful and real. That's really something that I want to have captured by now. I mean, when I look back at some of my early novels, I think they feel slightly, I mean, they're not too bad, but they feel slightly sort of contrived to me. And I really didn't want this to feel like that. I wanted it to feel absolutely, to follow a kind of emotional and sort of word pattern, in a sense, that feels truthful and real to the reader.
Mm. Well, I think you've certainly done it, Rose, but perhaps you could read now from
the
beginning.
Yes, absolutely. Don't be too afraid. I know reading for long periods of time is very tedious, but this is quite short. I mentioned that the novel starts when these boys are age five, and that there is this sort of the moment that Gustav sets eyes on the Jewish boy Anton, he loves him. There is no other word for it. He loves him. He wants to be his friend. He wants to care for him, and so on. He, at one point, he pesters Emily, his reluctant, unloving mother, to invite Anton to tea in their little, rather sort of shabby apartment. Anton's family live in a nice apartment, and Gustav and Emily live in this tiny little one. But he nevertheless wants to invite him to tea, and Emily keeps saying, no, I don't think so, we can do it. And then one day she says yes, and Gustav is so delighted that his friend is coming to tea, and this is what happens. I just need to tell you one thing, that the flat where they live is on a street called Unter der Egg, which is a name I found in a book about Switzerland. I thought it was so wonderful. I looked up what it means. It means under the harrow. So in fact, where this apartment building stands were fields, and then eventually allotments, and now it's an apartment block, and it's called Unter der Egg. So you have to imagine that Gustav and Anton are both five. It was late spring by the time the invitation to tea went out. It was agreed that Anton would walk from school to Unter der Egg with Gustav, and that his father would collect him from Emily's apartment at 6 o'clock. The father, it appeared, was a banker who'd worked for a large national bank in Bern and now worked for a smaller branch of that bank in Matzlingen. Matzlingen is the little town where they live. The reasons for the move weren't explained. All Anton said was that everybody in the family missed living in Bern. Herr Schweigel, the banker, missed his big bank. Frau Schweigel, who was a housewife, missed the wonderful shops, and Anton missed his old friends. Every May, in the courtyard at the back of the apartment, a white cherry tree bloomed. In this spring of 1948, perhaps because of the steady rains that had fallen at the end of winter, the flowers on the cherry were so abundant that the branches of the tree hung low towards the stones of the yard. Gustav's window, where he played with his tin train, overlooked the cherry tree, and he saw how the residents who went in and out of the building by that route almost invariably paused and stood staring at the tree with its cargo of beauty, and sometimes reached out to it as they might have reached out in yearning to a lost person. Emily said that there had once been cherry trees at the front of the building, all along Unter der Egg. But they'd been torn out now,
and there was just this one tree in the courtyard. She said, the tree is special for people because it's lasted through all the upheaval, as certain things seem to do. What things? Asked Gustav. Well, said Emily, like the white dog I showed you in that picture of the rubble of Berlin. It had survived. But you said it might have found a good master, or it might have starved to death. I know I did. But the point was, when everything around it had been destroyed, it was still there. It had hung on. So the Wednesday afternoon of the tea arrived. Gustav enjoyed walking home in the sunshine with Anton. He felt proud in a way that he couldn't explain. When Anton was introduced to Emily, Gustav saw that his mother stared at him for longer than she would normally stare at people she met for the first time. And Gustav wondered what was going through her mind. She said, you and Gustav go and play in his room for a little while, and then we'll have tea under Nussdotter. I hope you like Nussdotter. I don't know what it is, said Anton. Ah, said Emily, well, Gustav will explain it to you. They went to Gustav's room, where at this time of day, the sun was falling in a diagonal across the window. And Gustav said, Nussdotter is a sort of pastry thing with caramel and walnuts inside. But Anton wasn't listening. They were standing at the window sill next to the metal train. And Anton was staring down at the white cherry tree. He said, can we go down there? To play in the courtyard? I want to see that tree. It's just a cherry tree, said Gustav. Can't we go down there? Well, we'll have to ask Mutti. Emily said, all right, but I'll come with you. I don't want you making a noise on the stairs. You remember Herr Nieder is very ill, Gustav. Herr Nieder is our neighbour, said Gustav to Anton. He's dying. Oh, said Anton, has he got a piano? I don't know. Has he, Mutti? A piano, said Emily. Why do you ask? Well, said Anton, if he does, I could play Fleur de Lis for him. He might not want you to play Fleur de Lis, said Gustav. Oh, he would. Everybody likes me to play that. Well, not now, said Emily. Let's go down very quietly, shall we? So they arrived in the courtyard, and Anton stared at the cherry tree, and his dark eyes widened. He ran to the tree and began to hop from one foot to the other, and then to jump up and down, uttering little cries of joy. Gustav stood very still, watching Anton. He decided that there was something connecting Anton's joy at the sight of the cherry blossom to his early morning weeping at the kindergarten, but he couldn't say what. He went towards his friend and took his hand, and together they began to skip round and round the tree, laughing until they were out of breath. Gustav had no idea exactly why he was skipping, but he knew that Anton knew, and that seemed to be enough. One or two of the apartment residents arrived in the courtyard and stopped to smile at the two boys dancing round and round the old cherry tree. But later, when Anton had gone home, Emily said, I suppose there may not be any cherry trees in Bern. It's unlikely, I can't say for sure, perhaps he's never seen one before. I don't know, said Gustav. I think he is a nice boy, said Emily. But of course, he is a Jew. What's a Jew? Said Gustav. Ah, said Emily. The Jews are the people your father died trying to save.
Well, there's a chance for you now to ask any questions of Rose that you might have. I mean, it doesn't have to be about the new book. It can be about other work. So if there are any questions, if you could put up your hand and I'll try and make sure that I accurately relay what the question is, because I don't think there's a roving mic here, is there? No. So, any questions that anybody would like to ask about this novel or any other? Yes, please.
When you're creating your characters, do you tend to profile them in advance or let them evolve on the page?
Did everybody hear the question?
Yes.
Good. Okay, right.
I mean, profile is an interesting word. I think that is just about what it amounts to, a kind of outline, if you like, of them, of how they might be. And then to allow a kind of organic development as one gets deeper into the book. I think getting to know a fictional character is a bit like a friendship with somebody that you know you are drawn to. And then it takes you maybe quite some while to understand where they're coming from, who they are, whether they like the same things as you, etc., etc. Are they going to be your friend? Are they not going to be your friend? So there is a kind of a sort of emotional and intellectual progression here. And I'll give you one example of a character whose ending had to change, and this was the Merivale character in Restoration. And in those days, I was much more. I was much more anxious about, I think, that a book might somehow fail at some point in its construction. So I was more anxious than I am now to plan out the whole thing. And the ending that I had planned for Robert Merivale was that he would be completely reformed by his terrible ordeal in the middle of the novel, and that he would go back to being a doctor, and that he would renounce his obsession with the king and the court and with material possessions. And then I realised about, I don't know, perhaps 50 pages into this narrative, that I'd created a man who just wouldn't be able to do that. He would try very hard to do it, and he would not be able to succeed. And that was much more interesting to me as a shape for the narrative. So from that point on, I thought, well, we'll see how this goes. But maybe after all, he can do it, you know. But I think it's very important. I mean, if we had other writers here, they'd probably say different things. And I mean, Malcolm Bradbury was mentioned earlier, and I know, you probably know this too, John, that Malcolm kind of planned everything out, didn't he? He liked to have a real template for how the novel was going to go. But I like to discover as much as I can on the way and hope that it fits.
Just a supplementary to that, it's very interesting then that the character can come to resist your intentions.
Yes. I mean, it's a version of that old cliche about the characters taking over. It isn't that they take over, it's that they have by page, you know, round about page 50, they have a kind of integrity, I think, to them. They would do this, they would not do that. They do like this, they do not like that. You've created somebody who's beginning to be real, and so you have to honour that. That's my view. And you don't quite know. I mean, how far did I plan this book? I planned it certainly up to the moment where it goes backwards and has to research itself in order to help the reader move on. But I didn't absolutely know how it was going to end. I think in all the recent fiction that I've written, I decide upon the ending about two-thirds of the way through, when I really try to have a good understanding of what I've what I've earned. I think earning is the right word for this. You know, what have you earned here? What is, back to my thing about truth and reality, what is truthful?
Thank you.
Yes, please.
My question is sort of a follow-on from that. I haven't read the book yet, but I'm fascinated by this character because I know someone just like that, whose mother didn't love him, who's turned out a very civilised, affectionate, not a fiend. And did you know somebody like that, or did this come completely from your sort of imagination? And what if someone who was subjected to this set of circumstances turned out like that?
I think I know. I mean, I think I know quite a lot of people of my generation who weren't really loved by their parents, and I would include myself in that, actually. And I haven't turned into a fiend, or not yet, there's still time. But, I mean, this is a huge, sweeping generalisation, but I think my parents' generation, the parents who suffered the war and so on, which the Gustav's parents do, They did find it terribly hard to be good parents, that the war had stressed them, they'd lost people who were dear to them. They were not very good parents on the whole. I mean, this is far too sweeping, and of course there are wonderful exceptions to that, people who were loving parents. But I think it was a generation who found parenting very difficult because they had suffered so much and perhaps lost so much themselves. So I think I know lots of people who have turned out well, who were not loved. But I also know that not being loved, particularly if you've only got one parent, as Gustav has, that this can be catastrophic. I just didn't feel that in this case that would serve my narrative.
Yes, please.
Mine's a very simple question, which is leading on from what you said before, which is, how important is an ending?
How important is an ending? Do you mean in terms of, is it what the reader is hoping for? Do you think readers make up their minds about what they're hoping for with an ending? Well, I'm not sure I can add much to what I said earlier, is that actually in the kind of logical progression of the book, because it is a sort of, I think this is not to sentimentalise it, to say that it's a kind of living entity for me, the book, the characters in it. They're quite warm-blooded and breathing to me all the time. So the ending has to be the one that is right. It may be sort of the one that the readers can predict, or I think in this case they can't quite predict it, or they hope that this might happen and worry that it won't. And so there's all these questions about what kind of an ending might there be. But I just do return to the only way I know how to do it, which is to keep asking myself the question, and particularly at this two-thirds of the way through point, what is the most truthful ending? Particularly emotionally, I think, but in every way truthful. So, I mean, we've all read novels, haven't we, where they've gone along quite well, and then an ending arrives, and you think, what? You know, I remember this sort of William Trevor novel. I mean, I'm quite a fan of William Trevor's, but I remember reading a novel of his. I can't remember, I've deliberately not remembered the title of this novel, but it was by William Trevor, and it sets up the dilemma at the beginning of the book. It's about two people who are in love and who kind of are separated very early on in the book, and the whole novel is the reader is asking the question, are they going to find each other? Are they going to find each other? You know, where is he, where is she? It keeps on asking this question, and then you get to the end of the book and you don't know. And I thought, this is betrayal. You know, you can't have that, can you? I mean, come on. Let's give the reader some credit.
Yes, please.
What did you have to do to gain a feel, an accurate feel of the Swiss character?
Well, I mean, you could ask the question. You know, if we had, is there anybody Swiss in this audience, by the way? I had a couple the other night at the Guardian. They were very nice to me. I was relieved. How Swiss does he feel? If we had a Swiss audience here, they would say, well, there's ways in which a Swiss person would not do this or not do that. You know, that so it might not be, you know, as brilliant as I hope it is. But, I mean, to answer your question is I know Switzerland a bit. I was sent to a school there for a year after my own boarding school. And I have very fond memories of that time, actually. It was French Switzerland, not German Switzerland. But I have a very vivid memory of the landscape and the extraordinary beauty and also coldness of the winters. And then I did a lot of reading. I mean, Swiss history, of which Gustav knows nothing until a certain moment comes where he's falling behind at school and there's a very kind young teacher who comes to be quite important in helping him in all kinds of ways, who teaches him about Swiss history. And just sort of trying and looking at pictures. This is something that is very important for the writing of my fiction, is the visuals. I mean, I've done quite a lot of movie and film adaptations, and I think cinema feeds very well into the writing of novels. I think readers want to be able to see things as well as to know them. So I needed to get a very good, you know, starting from the tiny domestic, but moving outwards, starting from the flat where they live, down to the street, which used to be allotments, to the further town, to the hills that are around the town, it's a fairly kind of ordinary little town, but the hills around it are very beautiful, and then the mountains beyond that, and then my evocation later on of the magic mountain of Davos. So all of that had to be kind of visualised, and I felt if I had a really good visualisation of it, and what the school looked like, what they were, activities they were doing in the kindergarten, what it was like to go to this first concert with Anton, who is in a terrible state, and the hall where they have to play, which would be probably a bit like this, but much bigger. So all those things, I mean, I don't need an enormous amount of research to, I think, be able to realise, if you like, the landscape of the novel. I think novelists are like kind of wolfhounds. We kind of go rushing along, tearing this and taking that and leaving a lot behind and just selecting out. But that's part of the fun. And it's very interesting, I read a lot of books in order to write this, but actually coming across a little detail here and there, and you think, yes, that, but not that. And that's a mystery. I couldn't really say why, except it's helping to paint this picture. And I think readers want that. I hope, you know, if you read this book, that you'll be able to see it as well as understand it.
Thank you. There's time for one more question, because we're very new. Yes, please.
Did you worry about how much empathy to give good staff? Because empathy is quite a slowly developing attribute over life, essentially. And a lot of little children probably wouldn't have a great deal of empathy for anybody else, and particularly 5 years old.
Yes, I think definitely. I mean, I said earlier on that he's actually quite severe with Anton. He says, "What, you're stupid? Why are you crying? It's stupid. There's no point in it because you're not in your old school. You're in your new school now. So you should get on with it." So he's quite tough in a way. But I think we gradually learn that part of the mastery of the self that is being dinned into him by his mother, and by his circumstances, actually does lead to him thinking very deeply about what other people are feeling. And of course, this is what attracts Anton to him. He, Anton, who is a sort of, as I said earlier, is quite sort of selfish and mercurial, is tremendously grateful for this friend who doesn't keep judging him. He just gets on with you know, loving him, really. So, I mean, you're right about empathy. It's not something that children tend to have, and I'm not sure he has all that much of it in you know, as a child. But I think when he does acquire it in the third section, which leaps forward to when he's a man in middle age, we understand how he acquires it.
Thank you. Well, Rose is going to be available for a book signing, which I think is going to happen not here but through there. Somebody will wipe the way. Thank you all very much for coming this evening to listen to Rose and to talk to her about her work. But above all, Rose, thank you very much indeed, and thank you especially for a book that I think is remarkable and one of your best. So thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.